Chapter 22. Hail to the Heir. Move completed. The complete relocation of projects and shops from Abbotsford to Kernford took time, during which Joseph made the round trip twice more, to his frustration. He used it as an opportunity to improve his horsemanship. In Abbotsford, he walked the routes to and from their home, the town, his industrial park, and the abbey. In Kernford, that routine became impractical, due to the longer distances, and he rode one of the horses from his expanding personal stable. He rode Mr. Ed for the round trips to Abbotsford, particularly after the ride north to fetch Honorend, and Seabiscuit more often for short local trips. On the last trip to Abbotsford, he found himself reminiscing. With the final details of the move settled, he took an extra day to see the beach where they'd found him, his retreat cottage, Birdshit Bay, and the small valley with the jacaranda trees where he'd first kissed Mara. He also visited the abbey, where he lived those first months and made his first real connection with someone, Carnegie. He mentally replayed the courtyard scene of the desperate fight against the Baldurian raiders. He had no logical need to see these spots, but they were so much a part of who he had been and who he now was that he felt drawn to experience them one more time before he and his life moved on. When it came time to leave, there was no ceremony. He spent only a few minutes with Abbot Sistian Bainham, because Deira Bainham had gone to Kernford to help organize medical planning for future contingencies. As Joseph rode away, he stopped at the final hill to look back at the buildings of Abbotsford and the abbey. I wonder when I'll see this again, he thought. So much happened here, where I was so desolate, then so happy. He sat for several minutes reviewing the previous years, then urged Mr. Ed on and closed that door. Almost 100 other Abbotsford citizens preceded or followed him and Mara to Kernford. Carnegie, Cadwulf, Filton, Cales, Dennis, Balwis, workers and families. Cadwulf initially said no to moving, then agreed, on the condition he would stay only until the Narthani threat ended. Then he would return to Abbotsford to head the Applied Mathematics Department for the University of Cadellium at the Abbotsford campus. The reality of the Narthani threat, the Colescos move to Kernford, and the unrelenting arguments that the main university needed to be in a more central location than a relatively remote town forced all parties to accept that the planned university would have to be a lower priority than anyone involved desired, especially Joseph. Not that they shelved the idea, only delayed it. Until then, Cadwulf agreed to relocate to Kernford and continue oversight of Joseph's ever-expanding commercial enterprises and the Bank of Abbotsford, which had evolved into a major financial institution. Joseph had stubbornly refused to change its name to the Bank of either Keelan or Cadellium. No one understood his argument that B of K or B of C didn't sound as good as B of A. And his decision brought forth the usual shrugs and, well, you know, it's Joseph. Filton spoke of returning to Abbotsford one day to take over his father's work, but Joseph didn't reveal his conviction that his chief technical troubleshooter should find endless reasons and fascinations to delay the return for the rest of his life. Joseph intended to introduce as much new information as he could, as fast as the culture here could absorb it, and he would need as many Filton Fullers as he could find to make it happen. In Joseph's mind, the Colesco household relocation officially ended when they moved from Keelan Manor into their new home a half mile away. In contrast to Mara's last time leaving home, this one was a celebration, with relatives coming from Kernford and as far away as Clengoth to help move possessions and take part in a family housewarming that lasted well into the night. Joseph felt amazed and gratified that the builders had constructed the new home so quickly. They still had details to finish, and the smell of wood and paint would persist for months. But the house was now ready to be lived in. Anarind and Mera. Anarind recovered quickly, in a physical sense. Within 2 6 days, she had once again become the striking young blonde woman who turned men's heads, until they looked into a face with lines too prominent for someone her age, a closed expression, and sad eyes. Mera attempted to act as if nothing had happened during the previous months, and they were the same two young women, best friends, who told each other things they could tell no one else. It was only a pretense. After Anarin's experience with the raid on Landwin, her months of captivity and enslavement to an Arthani commander, the escape where she had helped kill a guard, her return home and rejection by her family, she would never be the same. Though neither was Mera the same. Her feelings of being out of place had receded as her life filled with multiple roles. Wife and mother-to-be were roles she had always expected, although with some trepidation. Yet she found it unexpected and exciting that her role of advisor to both the Hetman and Yosef Kolsko became more formal. Yosef had been the first to tell people how he depended on Mera's advice and help, and her father, after some hesitation and prodding by her mother, had followed suit. No matter their personal opinions, no Keelander wanted to argue with Hetman Keelan and Yosef Kolsko. Yes, Mera had changed, but not how she felt about Anna. Mera made efforts to keep Anarind active so she wouldn't withdraw. As her first effort, she assigned some of the household chores to Anarind. Mera could, with some rationale, claim she found these more difficult now that she was less mobile. Anarind acquiesced without comment. Her evolution to being more animated began when Mera volunteered her to keep tabs on the other escaped women, who were only slowly finding places in Keelan society. 12 of the women were employed by Mera, by Breda Keelan, or within Yosef's enterprises. The rest stayed temporarily at St. Tomo's Abbey or were taken in by kindly families. Mera also asked Anarin to maintain a written record of the progress of the other escaped women and keep up a regular written correspondence with those not in the immediate neighborhood. This gave Anarin a reason to practice and improve her reading and writing. Gwened Walston, Anarin's friend and co-escapee from Hounslow, and her daughter Morwena joined the Kolsko household when Mera initially thought to keep Gwened nearby to help Anarin adjust. Mera quickly found she liked the gruff, practical-minded woman and added her to the Kolsko staff with general duties, including secondary cook. While the Kolsko's new house was being built, Gwened lived in one of the visitor cottages on the Keelan Manor grounds, then moved to a cottage on the Kolsko estate. Mera sensed that Gwened would find her own role in Keelan society, but keeping her close for the moment worked well for all parties. However, after everyone moved into the new house, Gwened's hybrid roles as worker and friend created awkwardness. And Mera soon decreed that evening meals would include Gwened. Yosef took it in stride, eating with 3 women, but remained firm that morning meal was reserved for him and Mera, along with an occasional evening meal. Although Anarind had acted withdrawn in Yosef's presence at the beginning, Gwened added a dynamic at evening meals that prevented Anarind from staying silent. Anarind gradually became more animated. And within 3 6 days, Yosef saw the Anarind of Mera's stories. Arrival of the Heir. 1 month after Anarind's arrival, on the evening of 5th day, the 3rd 6th day of the month of Brunelan, Yosef, Mera, Anarind, and Gwened sat for evening meal as 2-year-old Morwena slept on a cushion in the adjoining great room. Mera had grown so large, she found it difficult to safely go from standing to sitting, so Anarind helped her sit down. The meal started with a vegetable soup that Josef insisted on calling minestrone. As usual, Josef and Merit talked about their day. Honorund still seldom said anything in Josef's presence, until prompted by Mera or Gwened. He had tried to engage her, to no avail, and finally gave up. Mera told Josef they had to be patient with Honorund, and that she would eventually open up to him and others. Mera lifted a spoonful of soup toward her mouth, then jerked, spilling the spoon contents back into the bowl, onto the table, and on herself.
"Arr!"
she grunted. The other three people stopped and looked at her.
"Ah!"
"Mera," said a concerned Josef. She looked at her husband.
"Just a sudden... pain!"
She leaned back, one hand on her bulging belly, the other on one side.
"I had a cramp or something."
Honorund looked at Josef. His first thought was that Honorund had never before looked directly at him during the entire time since he'd brought her and the other women to Kernford. The anticipatory look in Honorund's face triggered a second thought.
The baby!
Mera began to breathe deeper and faster, her face in a slight grimace.
"It keeps coming and going."
Light dawned in Mera's face.
I think it might be that time.
Suddenly, Mera jerked and looked down.
"Ah! What? Oh! I think my water broke."
That time it was. While Honorund and Gwened helped Mera to the bedroom, Josef ran the half mile to the Keelan Manor. Running was faster than saddling a horse, not that Josef was in a frame of mind to make that deduction. Once he'd alerted Breda Keelan, she took charge, sent for medicines, and had a carriage brought to the Kolsko house. Josef had already run back home. They took Mera to Keelan Manor, where the first grandchild of the Hetman would be born. Although this would be the second child he'd fathered on Anyar, this time Josef was on site and knew it would really be his, one he would help raise. Within 2 hours, a crowd had gathered at Keelan Manor, including Hetman advisors, boyarmen who happened to be in Kernford, Abbot Walcott, and scores of others. Josef wouldn't have recognized most of them, even if he'd been aware of anything except worry about Mera as he wandered around thinking he should be doing something. The father being present at a birth was not a Cadellium custom, so Josef paced outside the house, waiting with the other men. Several medicants attended Mera, and Honorund stayed with her the entire time. When the medicants first arrived, they reported that Mera was definitely in labor. Everything was progressing normally, and people should relax, because it would be many hours before the baby arrived. That advice proved faulty when only 4 hours later, a squalling 8-pound boy made his appearance. When Josef was allowed in to see the mother and child, several people commented that Mera looked better than he did. She sat up in bed, in one arm holding a small bundle of reddish flesh with squeezed shut eyes. With the other arm, she tried to eat a bowl of beef stew. Josef relieved her of the bowl and spoon-fed her until she fell asleep. 2 God's Days later, Josef and Mera formally presented their newborn in St. Tomo's Cathedral. Attendance overflowed. College formally acknowledged the boy as his grandson, and when the time came for Josef to declare the boy's name, he had prepared this time and gotten Mera's approval for the name. Aeneas. When Mera had asked him about the origin of the name, Josef told her Aeneas was a legendary warrior who wandered, then founded a mighty empire called Rome, and whose descendants included famous rulers named Julius Caesar, Augustus, and King Arthur. Mera merely nodded with satisfaction at the appropriateness. Josef left out certain details, such as Aeneas fleeing the fall of Troy, and that the Roman Empire was not all that different than the Narthoni. He figured that although no one on Anyar or Earth knew of his fate, if in some distant future contact occurred between the planets, he would have left clues that this future contact was not the first. He also wondered how many more clues he would eventually leave. Home life with Aeneas. Aeneas Kolsko was a sleeping, eating, squalling, shitting lump. And in the coming 6 days, Mera expressed bewilderment at how eagerly Yosef held the little bundle, at least until he needed changing. The Kadeli considered tending infants solely a woman's task, and Mera could remember that many months had passed before her father first held each of her two youngest sisters, and then only briefly. But this was Yosef, so different in so many ways. Why not this one too? Although Yosef wondered how he would balance helping care for a baby with all of his other obligations, he hadn't factored in his and Mera's status, Kadelium customs, or the available assistance. The expected midnight feedings and changings never materialized. Gwen had amicably shared her cottage with Mira Melkillen, a young widow and wet nurse with a baby daughter, Dwina. With Honorand, Gwened, and Miramel on hand, Yosef had no required time with Aeneas, only time he made for regular holding. Even Mera spent less time with Aeneas than she'd expected. She nursed the baby several times a day, but Miramel was on hand for other feedings, and Mera only partly supplied the constant attention a new infant needed. Within 2 6 days, she found herself once more immersed in her activities, albeit not full-time. The newborn's parents talked about their perceived lack of attention to Aeneas, but both settled on spending time each day with the baby, more Mera than Yosef. They told themselves and each other that the baby wouldn't know the difference at this age. Yosef believed it, and Mera told herself she did. Thus did life at the Kolsko household settle into a routine, modified from the past only in that the baby and the attendants added to the general bustle.